Welcome back to the Bible in Context on another wonderful rainy day.
It rains every single time we get together.
That's well, all right. At least we're inside.
Yeah, it could be worse.
All right, well, this time we're going to go through chapter 20 in Genesis. And so this story starts off in verse 1, just to dive right in here, with another journey through the Negev. That will tell us a lot about the upcoming story if we just pay attention to that little word. So where have we seen the Negev before?
At the beginning, wasn't it in chapter 12?
Yep. Chapter 12, verse 9, Abraham begins a journey through the Negev on his way down to Egypt.
Oh, that's right.
So what we should, I guess we should expect something kind of like what happened in chapter 12 in Egypt to happen again. And we're going to find out this exactly what happens. We have another sister fib story, another exodus of Sarah out of a king's house, and a lot of elements that coordinate with that to show this is another exodus of Sarah out of a king's house.
Yeah, the parallel story in chapter 12 is pretty remarkable, just how many of the elements are very, very, very similar. And this is really part of the bigger chiasm of Abraham's life, where at the beginning and then at the end, you've got these genealogies that act as bookends. At the beginning, you've got the genealogy of his father, Abraham's father, and then at the very end in chapter 20, I think it's at the end of chapter 22 or maybe the beginning of chapter 23, you've got the genealogy of his, I believe his brother, is put in there. And so those act as bookends. And then from there, going inward, you've got the sister fibs. And then you've got two stories, or actually two chapters on both sides of Lot needing to be rescued. And then in the middle of those, you've got three chapters of the covenant relationship between Abraham and Yahweh. And that's kind of the heart of the story. You've got mirrors at the beginning and the end with just God testing Abraham. At the beginning, he tests him and tells him to leave everything he knows and go to the promised land. At the very end, he tests him again by asking him to sacrifice Isaac, his only son. And I think there's a lot more mirroring factors in there that I'm probably not remembering off the top of my head. But so yeah, this is part of the greater chiasm. And it's helpful, I think, for us to take a look at chapter 12 as we're reading through chapter 20 and really see how they compare and contrast to one another.
Yeah, we'll learn some new things and see really Abimelech is a different character than Pharaoh. So seeing him in this repeated story, we learn some new things about some new people and some ways that God and the elect will interact with these new sort of people. Since this is especially fresh on my mind too, I think it's worth saying that this is not, you know, some people will read this and say, look, it's just like chapter 12. And so this was part of some, it's the same story, but there were two different traditions of it and they sloppily pasted it together, forgot that these stories were already put in the Bible. So they accidentally put it in twice from a source critical perspective. So anyway, that's not what happened. This is actually part of the literary structure in the chiasm and trying to use the same story with the same Exodus motif to teach us new things. Yeah, integral part of the literary structure, not an accidental sloppy copy and paste job.
Yeah, absolutely.
Again, we got another sister lie scene here. So we got in verse 2, again, Abram says that she's my sister to Abimelech.
Yeah, we find out this is a half lie or a half truth.
Yeah, we finally find that out. And he does it for the same reason, because he thought that there's no fear of God in the land. So he needs to lie to keep himself safe. So again, for the sake of safety, he lies about Sarah being his half-sister. And he does say in verse 12, he says, besides, she is my sister, the daughter of my father. So half-sister, in this culture, that's not too weird to us, but
yeah,
it's, you know, it is what it is.
It was acceptable back then.
Yeah. I guess you had slim pickings, possibly.
Well, so there is that, yeah.
Trying to keep your honor in the family, so that's...
Right.
Yeah. We find out there's a grain of truth in it, but again, he's trying to justify himself in that statement. We'll get to that in a few minutes. So, yeah, Abimelech, it says in verse 2 there at the end of it that he took Sarah. So we don't have the full, like, seeing and taking paradigm here, but
right,
we have, you know, again, just like Pharaoh took her, just like the sons of God took women, just like Eve took the fruit, we still have, I think, that pattern,
that hyperlink,
yeah, brought up again here as Abimelech takes Sarah. So we also see kind of how Sarah becomes a forbidden fruit later in this story with Abimelech. She becomes kind of a forbidden fruit in a way. So this is just riffing on that same motif. she's been taken, a wrong has been committed, and so Yahweh comes to Abimelech at night in a dream and tells him, okay, you're a dead man because you took this woman and she's another man's wife.
Now, I don't recall Pharaoh having a dream, but there was plagues. That's how he knew.
Yeah, that's right. And I think actually the dream is here to set up the next question, because in this, Abimelech needs to have a conversation with God in order to have this question brought up, or at least, you know, some way to facilitate this question, because it's going to play off some of the same concerns that we had back in chapter 18 and chapter 19.
Right. So we're looking at verse 4?
Where
it says, now Abimelech had not approached her, and so he said, Lord, will you kill an innocent people? So God comes to him in a dream, says, you're a dead man because you've taken this woman that doesn't belong to you. And Abimelech says, no, I haven't done anything to her. I'm innocent. And so he asks this very important question, Lord, will you kill an innocent people?
Yeah, and that word innocent, it's tzaddik, which is the same word for righteous that was used in chapters 18 and 19 whenever Abraham is saying, like, are you going to kill the righteous people in Sodom too? Are you going to let the righteous die with the wicked? So we have the same concern brought up again in this story. Is Yahweh going to kill the righteous?
Right. It's interesting too. Abimelech does not address God as Yahweh here. It says Lord, but it's the lowercase. But I just think that's interesting. And it fits with the pattern. I mean, he's not part of the covenant people, and so he would not know God as Yahweh.
And so he says that also, in the integrity of my heart, I've done this, and in the innocence of my hands, I have done this. And so Yahweh responds, yes, I know that you haven't done anything to her yet. You've done this in the integrity of your heart. You didn't know that she was another man's wife. And he says that I'm the one that kept you from sinning.
So how did he keep him from sinning?
Well, yeah, we actually, right before we were recording, we had a theory about that. and this is just a suggestion. We don't really know if this is right or not, but it would make sense with the flow of the story. Let's skip down to verse 17, where Abraham prays to God to undo a plague that's been on Abimelech's household. It says that Abimelech was healed as well as his wife and female slaves so that they bore children. So Abimelech's wife and female slaves, all the people he would have been essentially having children with, and he are healed. So what's up with Abimelech? Well, it says that the women's wombs were closed, and so there's something of a reproductive nature going on here. And so it probably makes sense, and again, this is, again, just a suggestion, but it fits the story, that Abimelech might have had some kind of infirmity on his reproductive organs that made him not want to do that. So.
Well, and the reason we're thinking that is because if it was just they became infertile, I mean, it would have taken months for them to really figure that out. It's not like they had tests back then to determine it right away. And so the fact that Abimelech had to be healed also, perhaps there was something that was wrong with him that was very obvious, and immediately they knew that they had an issue.
Right. And well, I guess he may have still been doing that, because otherwise they wouldn't have known that the women had been plagued as well with infertile wombs, because, you know, that's how you test that, is you just go for it.
Right, right. Oh, who knows? I mean, it could have been. In the Bible, I think, appropriately does not go into detail about that.
Yeah.
And so we appreciate that, so our kids can read this.
Yeah, and so just as a guess, yeah, Abimelech might have had some kind of infirmity like that that affected his whole reproductive system, and probably something that was fairly obvious, since, especially back in that culture, you wouldn't have no tests for men's infertility, and the only way you would know that is, you know, for months not having kids. So
yeah, my sense is there had to be something that they could see that was wrong. But again, we're just speculating here.
Yeah,
so it's hard to tell.
So maybe that infirmity is the reason that he was not able to go and sin against Abraham yet by sleeping with Sarah and against Sarah. So there's a lot of unknowns in this passage, but just a suggestion. There are also some problems with it, but
yeah. So it's interesting, because if that's the case, the plague that was put on Abimelech was also God's grace, in a sense.
Yeah.
But again, we're speculating here. Take what we're saying with a grain of salt.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, that there's no real clues to what's going on with him, other than just like Abimelech was healed too, and so were his wives. So there's like something going on there where they know the women are infertile, but also something's up with him, and we just...
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So obviously something's going on with him and his his concubines to know that they were infertile, but at the same time,
anyway,
the Lord kept him from sinning, very possibly through making it physically inconvenient to sin.
Right.
But like you said, I think the point here is God had grace on him and kept him from being able to sin, and making it to where there's kind of this situation where Abimelech could bring Sarah back to Abraham and create like a no harm, no foul situation.
Yep.
Yeah, she was away from her husband for, who knows, this could have been, you know, almost the whole year that they were waiting for Isaac. But she goes back to Abraham and nobody was harmed, no one was slept with, so no harm, no foul. So then Yahweh instructs Abimelech in this dream, now go return the man's wife, for he's a prophet, and he will pray for you, and you shall live. But if you don't return her, then you shall surely die, and all who are yours. And there's a few interesting things in that statement. So do you want to talk about Abraham being a prophet?
Yeah, sure. So this is actually the first place in the Bible that somebody is called a prophet. And so prophet throughout the Old Testament is somebody who speaks on behalf of God. And it's evident here, too, though, that the reason Yahweh is telling him to go and ask him to pray is because he's a prophet. Go ask him to pray for you because he's a prophet. Now, you'd almost think he would say because he's a priest, somebody who's going to intercede for you, but he says because he's a prophet. So there's a little bit of overlap between prophets and priests.
Well, and I think there's actually, we can narrow that definition of prophet down a little bit that will make some sense from the last story. So a prophet, as well as speaking for God, usually prophets are commissioned, but usually they've gained a seat on the divine council, or they've at least been in the presence of Yahweh and his council. I mean, you think of Isaiah and Isaiah 6,
right.
Or Yahweh comes to Jeremiah, all these kinds of things. And so here, where was Abraham in chapter 18?
He was having a conversation with the divine council.
Yes. So he's got a seat on the divine council now. He's been let in on their plans. That's usually the big thing that defines a prophet, is the prophet has been let in on the plans of Yahweh and his council.
Right.
So
right.
We've got that here.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And so, but yeah, you see Abraham, prophet, called a prophet. We've already seen him act in a priestly manner as he's interceded on behalf of his nephew Lot and Sodom. And here he's going to be interceding on behalf of Abimelech.
And making sacrifices.
Building altars. I mean, he's had a priestly role for a while now. And he's acted like a king too. I mean, putting together an army and going to war. And
had promises of there will be kings coming from him.
Yeah.
He'll be the father of nations, which we're going to look at that later as we get down the road. But Joseph has become a father to Pharaoh.
Right.
And so there is kind of a kingly connotation to being a father to leaders.
Yeah. And so, yeah, you absolutely see all three of the offices of Christ being foreshadowed in the life of Abraham, prophet, priest, and king.
Which, now that you said that, I just want to bring up that, like, this is not just Abraham. Remember, we actually just talked about typology. Was that last week?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So we just talked about typology, how there's these patterns of how Yahweh is redeeming his people. We see Adam, he has that kind of prophet, priest, king status.
Yep.
We don't see prophet strictly, but he's in the garden where God is. So, I mean, I think you can kind of assume it. Noah, he as well is spoken to by God, given commands of God, let in on the plans of the divine council. And then he is giving priestly sacrifices. He's not really a king, but he is given the firstborn blessing and the promises of the king that will come to crush the serpent. So these three titles, prophet, priest, king, I mean, you could probably divide these up different ways or add some more to them. But Yahweh, as he picks someone to be part of his redeeming plan, he puts them in these positions.
Yeah, absolutely.
He makes them have this character. Yeah, Jesus is just the last one in that line to finally get those roles and then fulfill them to a higher degree.
Yeah. Well, in a sense, then you've got the church. As we're commissioned as the church, I mean, we're called royal priesthood. We're called royal ambassadors. There's a prophet, priest, king within the church. We play that role.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, everything,
collectively.
Yeah, like we're getting off track a little bit, but like everything that applies to Christ in a lesser degree applies to every part of his body as well.
Absolutely,
I mean, we are his body. I mean, that's why Paul says, like, he will crush the serpent under your feet.
Yeah.
Well, Jesus was a serpent crusher. Yes.
Right.
Right. His body.
Yeah.
You know.
And one day we'll rule
on his throne. Like Revelation says.
Yeah.
Anyway, I guess let's get back to Genesis. But anyway, just another typological plug there. All right. So I do want to talk about in verse 7, back to that. So Abraham is a prophet. He'll pray for you so that you'll live. If you don't return her, you shall surely die. And this phrase, you shall surely die, is mot temut. It's the same phrase, you shall surely die. In the Hebrew, it's more like, you know, dying, you will die. It's the same phrase that you see applied to the fruit in the garden.
Mm.
And so here you go. Sarah is made more like the fruit in the garden once again. He has taken that fruit, but he hasn't eaten it yet. And God's saying, like, look, you haven't eaten it yet, just put it back. No harm, no foul. Let's just take care of it. Yeah, and that phrase, you shall surely die, is in Genesis 2:17. So we have another link back to the garden story in that. And it's interesting, though, that it portrays Abimelech as like this Eve who has been kept from eating because she didn't realize which fruit she picked.
Hmm.
So Abraham, in this whole construct here, this pattern that we see throughout Scripture, again, we see this seeing and taking pattern throughout Scripture. This time, we have Abram, he's the serpent. He's the deceiver, our elect one.
Right.
And then Sarah, she's the fruit, and Abimelech is in the slot of Eve.
Right.
And so Abimelech is tricked into taking the fruit, not because he's been tricked into desiring it more than God's word, because he just straight up doesn't know.
Right.
And so God says, look, because of the bad thing you've done, there is something wrong with the situation. So here's a physical manifestation showing you something is wrong, but you haven't carried through on this yet. So here's the chance to stop it if you want to.
Gotcha. Good connections. I had not seen Sarah as the fruit, the forbidden fruit, until you just pointed that out.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And she plays that same role back in chapter 12, and she'll play it again. I think, you know, anytime you see that seeing and taking, that's kind of what's going on. You'll see that with, I think, Dinah. She plays that where Shechem sees her and takes her. The same words aren't used exactly, but the framework is kind of there whenever Potiphar's wife is trying to take Joseph. It shows up where different people become the fruit, but it allows us to kind of creatively think about being deceived into sin or seeing what is good in our eyes and taking, and the different ways that Yahweh will show grace and justice and the ways people react and their choices.
It's good stuff.
Next we have in verse 8, Abimelech, he rose early in the morning and called all of his servants together and told them all these things, and they were very much afraid. So they're afraid God's going to kill them. Now Abimelech, he rose early in the morning. And I've looked up where this phrase appears throughout the Bible, and it seems to me that often it occurs whenever it's talking about someone has some urgency about them. Yeah, this phrase usually refers to just people having haste in the Bible, having an urgency about them. They rise early in the morning and go to do something that is important.
Yeah, Abraham's going to rise up early in the morning later in this chapter to send off Ishmael and Hagar after being obedient to the Lord's word.
So yeah, because of this, he gets up, he tells all of his people that if they don't return Sarah, they're going to die, and they're all afraid. They think they're all going to die. So Abimelech calls Abraham, and he says, what have you done to us?
Right, which is just about the same thing that Pharaoh said back in chapter 12.
Right, and that God said to Cain.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And that God said to Eve.
Yep.
And so it's the same question again, putting now Abraham is more so in the position of Eve, the one who has sinned. He's not playing the snake anymore. I mean, it's a pretty fluid image. So,
right, yeah.
You know. But yeah, now he's the one who has sinned and he's being indicted. You know, what have you done? Now you've taken the fruit, in a sense, and eaten it.
Yeah.
It's really cool how these patterns can be used so fluidly just to show us so much and help us reflect on different ways that, I guess, just that sin comes about.
So next we have Abraham, like, reeling and giving all of these excuses, like, multiple excuses. Why? Because Abimelech asks him, what did you see that you did this thing? In other words, like, what were you thinking? Like, what was going through your head? And so Abraham says, I did it because I thought that there was no fear of God in this place. I thought you were going to kill me because of my wife, which is the same excuse basically that he had given to Pharaoh. And then he goes on to say, well, she really is my sister, just my half-sister. Yeah. I wasn't fully lying to you. I mean, it's like a kid getting caught in the cookie jar, right? I'm just trying to come up with any excuse to justify why he did what he did.
And I like what you pointed out, that you know, and God caused me to wonder, like, ultimately it's his fault. Which, again, we're going back to this Eden pattern where the man says, you gave me this woman.
Right.
And she blames shifts, and it just goes on down the line. So he's doing the same thing where he's blaming other people, he's blaming God, and just...
Yeah, saying that. What I did, he's minimizing it, he's blame shifting. He's doing all the things that we do still today when we get caught doing something we know we shouldn't have done.
And so the Bible recognizes this. It's like, this is just a pattern in humans. That's why it's playing this over and over again.
Well, and he even closes off with, like, even... Like, even my wife was okay with us.
Right.
She was compliant.
Yeah. And we should say something, too, about the fact that all who belonged to Abimelech would have died because of this. I think it's probably worth just bringing up. So there is, like, the corporate solidarity idea present here. But there's also the idea of sin brought into the land defiles the land as well. And we saw that in Genesis 6. We see that in Leviticus 17, 18, 26, one of those chapters about the Canaanites having defiled their land.
Yeah, there's a ripple effect from the sin.
And there is also, I think an assumption that you can leave your leadership and go somewhere else. I think that's implied in here because of, we have, for instance, Rahab, where the land of the Canaanites has been defiled by their sin. And she's a woman, so she should be under the headship of a man in this culture.
Okay.
And she breaks out of that, and instead, any who come to her now and come into her household are now saved along with her because they have trusted her Yahweh-looking leadership.
Okay.
We talked about this with the reason that Lot was able to bring his family out. But even his wife, who was under his purview, when she changed her loyalties back to Sodom, she suffered the fate of the Sodomites.
Right.
So, same thing here, where, look, if we're all complicit, if we all follow Abimelech into sin, then, we're going to suffer his fate. But if we change our loyalties, then we won't suffer his fate.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
Not said explicitly, but we see that pattern enough throughout Scripture that I think we can assume it in these stories, especially since we're so quick to see these often and say, like, man, God's a jerk.
Right.
And it's like, that's not what's going on.
Right, yeah. Okay, and so next we see Abimelech ends up giving him sheep and oxen and male servants and female servants and also a bunch of silver, which is highlighted here, I noticed. And land. Like, you can live wherever you want to. And that's different from Pharaoh. Pharaoh's like, get out.
Yeah.
Abimelech is, hey, wherever you want to go.
Yeah, so Abimelech here, unlike Pharaoh, who does send him away and kind of... contrary to the Exodus Pharaoh, who enslaves the people he's afraid of, the chapter 12, Genesis 12 Pharaoh sends him away. He wants nothing more to do with him. Abimelech, he just, hey, here's, I think, some extra here in the silver, whereas that's not where he gets in other places where he acquires wealth. And then he gets freedom to just choose the land. And so in that, there's an understanding that they might dwell together and there will have to be some sort of friendship in that.
Right.
And we'll see that does come to fruition later.
In the next chapter,
Now, where have we seen before that someone acquires wealth and servants, other people?
Well, back in chapter 12.
Chapter 12, yeah.
And then, again, we'll see it in the Exodus.
Mm-hmm. And some other places throughout Genesis, but yeah. So the first time was in chapter 12, and then again here in chapter 20. This is just, again, part of the Exodus motif, because as she comes out from Abimelech's house, and then Abraham and Sarah go out from Abimelech. They're coming out with new riches that they acquired from the place that they're exiting, and they have a mixed multitude of people in these male and female servants that he acquires in verse 14.
Yeah, and there seems to be this theme that keeps getting developed over and over and over of God's faithfulness in the midst of our foolishness. Mm-hmm. Abraham acting foolish here, lying about his wife, and yet God protects Sarah, even protects Abimelech in a sense, and then makes Abraham and his family even richer, keeping his promises as he said he would, protecting the seed of Sarah, or really the seed of Abraham, by not allowing Abimelech to sleep with Sarah. And so, you see God's faithfulness all through this chapter, I think.
Yeah, and again, just working through the same pattern to redeem his people, which is what you just said, but yeah. So Yahweh has worked through Abraham, despite his mistakes here, and now he's going to use Abraham to heal Abimelech. So he's going to use now his elect one to bless the nations.
Yeah, and so, there's a lesson here, too, that God's trying to teach him to trust my faithfulness And so he does that in a pretty powerful way as he controls the wombs of Abimelech's whole household, which would have been a pretty significant miracle. Very significant, especially in light of what we've seen already in Abraham's life, where he's promised them this child at a very old age. They both have laughed at God because of this. And now God's like, look, trust me, I can do whatever I want to do.
Yeah. There's been this nagging question thus far of, yes, we as the readers know that God has created the world, but there's still this question of them, and maybe even some readers, of like, okay, but God, does God control the womb? Does he have power over the opening and closing of even the womb of a 90-year-old woman? Well, here in this story, finally that tension is relieved. God is completely able to do that. He has healed the wombs of, well, closed and opened the wombs of an entire household. So God is definitely able to deliver on his promise, but when will he? That's the only tension hanging left.
That tension breaks pretty quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, as soon as
in the very next chapter.
Yeah. We'll dive into the next chapter next time. But for now, we do see that Abraham, through his intercession, again, God is determined to refine his elect one and then use that elect one to bless the nations. He is still faithful to have this family be the conduit of his blessing and his mediation, and that the families of the earth should come to this family, come to Abraham, come to the elect one in order to find Yahweh. That's what's going on here as Abraham does this priestly act for Abimelech. So just one more time, let's run through why is this one an Exodus? And I just want to keep highlighting this as we go, because the Exodus is everywhere and it just helps us recognize the patterns a little better and be able to learn from the way that these patterns show up, the way they're changed, the elements that are added, the elements that are taken away. So again, we start out with a journey through the Negev. So that one cues us up to think like, oh, okay, this is going to be similar to chapter 12, where they went down to Egypt. There is the lie about Sarah being Abraham's sister, and then she is taken and oppressed by a king, and then that king is afflicted with plagues of some sort. The king sends Sarah out, and then Abraham and Sarah come out with a bunch of riches, you know, cattle, sheep, oxen, all those things, and male and female servants, so there's a mixed multitude as well. And then there's something that causes Abraham to be likened to a priest. In Genesis 12, it was a sacrifice. Here he is interceding for Abimelech and his household and playing the role of prophet. There are blessings to be fruitful and multiply in chapter 12. In this one, we don't have explicit blessings, but we're going to see the fruition of a promise of fruitfulness happen in about a verse or so. And then the last element, at least that I've seen, last large element in this that relates to the Exodus, is that in chapter 12, Abraham receives his wife back after the end of this Exodus. Here, the same thing happens, just like Yahweh, or at least similar to the way Yahweh receives his bride at the end of the Exodus of Israel.
So that pattern goes over and over and over. It's almost like we are probably supposed to see it.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, it probably sounds like we're beating a dead horse, but I think it's worth knowing that it's there so that we can examine the text and kind of feel the tensions that should be there. I mean, whenever we've gotten to the point of, okay, they pass through the Negev, he's lied about his sister, she's been taken by a king, what happens next? If she's not somehow delivered and they're given riches and there's not something priestly going on, if she doesn't go back to Abraham, all those different twists and turns would tell us something different about this and create new expectations or teach us new things. And so that's why we need to be kind of attuned to these patterns through the text. All right, well, next time we will dive into the birth of Isaac in chapter 21, and then finally hit the climax of chapter 22, which might take a couple episodes, but that'll be a good one.
Sounds good.